You're listening to the Vegans Explore Network, found at vegansexplore.com.
Today, we have a leader in the animal rights movement joining us to talk about many things dealing in the world of veganism and, of course, being compassionate. So we have Earthling Ed. Thank you so much for joining SoFlo Vegans.
Yeah, my absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for inviting me to do this. And it's a real privilege to be able to speak to about veganism to you and indeed all of the South Florida community. I'm really excited.
And what my intention for this conversation is to wring all of your insights and knowledge about the animal rights movement and share it with our community so we can continue to grow and build and, you know, be there for all beings.
Sounds great.
So let's get started for people who may be watching this and not familiar with your particular movement. Give us a little bit of background on who Earthling Ed is.
Yeah, so I'm a UK grassroots animal rights activist. I've been doing it now for about 2 years. I set up a YouTube channel as my first form of activism, where I was making content about veganism, vegan education, but I also went out on the streets and kind of had conversations with people, talking to them about the morality of consuming animal products and the morality of veganism. And from there, I kind of progressed to doing more outreach stuff on the streets, doing things like Anonymous the Voiceless, and then going to Save Movement vigils. And it's really just kind of like progressed from there, really. I now co-direct an animal rights organization in the UK called Surge, and we host lots of events, one of them being the Official Animal Rights March, which is kind of expanding now into a global annual march all about animal rights, all about the abolition of animal exploitation. I'm just kind of a UK animal rights activist trying to do my bit to spread the message as much as possible, really.
And what do you think about your message has resonated with the audience? Why have what your particular way of speaking to people that passerbys, what about your approach is really resonating not only with the people you're reaching out to, but the people who are watching you and being moved by what you're doing?
I mean, it's a good question. Sometimes it's a bit strange for me because I don't think that I do anything that other people wouldn't necessarily be able to do. But I think what people often say to me is this kind of the calmness that people respond well to. And I think for me, what kind of triggered a lot of what I do now was having conversations with non-vegans and not knowing what to say to them. And it would really bug me when I didn't know how to respond. So I kind of made it a bit of a mission of mine to educate myself as much as possible and learn as much as possible about all the excuses and arguments that people use to justify not going vegan. And in doing so, I wouldn't be in a situation where I'd avoid as much as possible being in situations where I'd be having a conversation with a non-vegan and they'd say something that I couldn't respond to. So I think just by kind of arming myself with as much knowledge as possible, it allowed me to kind of be calm and allowed me to hopefully be as informed as I could be for those conversations. I think that's what people respond well to, is just kind of that demeanor of I guess it's empathy as well. And what I always try and keep in mind when I'm talking to people is that I was once in their situation, meaning I once ate animal products. And there was a reason why I did that. And there's a reason why they still do that. And for me, it would not have been productive if someone had kind of belittled me or kind of talked aggressively to me. That would have, you know, spurred me to research veganism or think about veganism. And I thought, well, if that wouldn't work for me, what would work for me? And that would be kind of a calm, rational, logical discussion. And I thought, well, if that's what would work for me, it would make sense for that to work for everyone else that I talked to. So I kind of used that empathy, that kind of reasoning to keep myself calm and level-headed. Now, obviously, by no means does that mean that I don't get frustrated and angry and annoyed at times, because, you know, we're all humans and we all care deeply about the cause, so it's only logical that would be the case. But at the same time, I always try to maintain that element of calmness and empathy. I think is probably the good word for it.
So there, you say you started the YouTube channel. So what prompted you? And we're gonna get into your path into veganism. But what prompted you to start a YouTube channel? What was the impetus for that?
It's interesting, really. I mean, I've been vegan for quite a while, but kind of a passive vegan. And I was always afraid of being labeled preachy or militant or extremist or whatever kind of negative word people associate with vegans. And for that reason, I always kept quite quiet and didn't want to impose my views, if you like, or force my opinions. But it started to sit really kind of restlessly with me, and I couldn't really justify being quiet anymore. I was watching all these documentaries. I was learning all the information. I've seen the graphic footage, and knowing that information, but not vocalizing it or speaking up on behalf of those that are oppressed, just seemed like an injustice. And I kind of got this a feeling inside of me that to remain silent was to be complicit still. And even though I wasn't actively engaging in those industries with my own money, by being quiet, I was almost allowing them to continue. So I kind of got spurred on. My partner was like, you should set up a YouTube channel. And at the time when she first mentioned that, I was like, there's no chance I'm going to do that. No chance. And you know, the first couple of videos I recorded, I just deleted them, had to do them again, hated it, thought it was terrible, this isn't going to work for me. And then slowly, I guess I just built more confidence. But I think it was just that feeling inside me that I needed to do something. And back then, 2 years ago, YouTube was, and it still is a big thing now, but it was a really big tool within the vegan community. A lot of activists were on YouTube. And I just felt like it was one of the best platforms for kind of getting the information out there. Because the beauty of social media is you never know who's going to see it. And you just don't know who it's going to come across. I think sometimes we get stuck in that echo chamber. But the beauty of social media is it has that power and potential to get shared anywhere. And for that reason alone, I kind of felt that it was an important thing to do. So, yeah.
So you created the, when did you create the YouTube channel, Ron?
Yeah, so January 2016, so 25 months ago.
Okay. And so you created the YouTube channel. How long before it started to pick up and people really started to?
And this is the thing, YouTube, right? It's a difficult platform. And it took me a long time. I think I was looking about 6 months before I started getting anywhere that I was kind of content with. And I think what happens for a lot of people, and it certainly happened for me, is you put so much effort at the beginning, you're making videos and they're just not being seen. And you kind of get frustrated and you don't know why. You're pouring your heart and soul into it. The information's good. You know, you think you're doing well, but it's just not getting out there. And it took me probably a good 6 months before I started to kind of reach a bit more of a broader audience. But even then, it took me a year to get to somewhere where I felt established. And I guess really, it's a long, arduous process. And people sometimes say to me, like, oh, I want to set up a YouTube channel. And I'm like, please go for it. It's such a fantastic thing. But just remember, don't be disheartened if it's difficult at the beginning, because it is for everyone, or it is for most people. And I think that's why I say to everyone, it doesn't matter what type of activism you get involved in. But the thing about social media activism is it will be difficult at the beginning, and you shouldn't be disheartened by it if you are struggling to find those followers or get those views. And as long as you just keep churning it out and you're consistent and the quality remains, you know, as good as it can be, eventually something good will happen from it, or good will come from it.
So when you started the YouTube channel, were you also engaged in on the street activism, or did that take time for you to get to that point?
It was about 5 months later before I started doing on the street activism. And I don't really know why it took me so long. I think I was nervous and I think I was a bit afraid and I didn't want to kind of make a fool of myself or throw myself at the deep end and not do the animals justice. And I kind of like lulled myself to think, well, because it's making videos, if I don't like it, I can delete it or not upload it. But when you're on the street having that conversation with someone, you can't delete the conversation, right? What happens, happens. And the conversation you have is permanent. And I think I was really afraid for such a long time of making a mistake that I kind of put it off. And as I say, it took about 5 months. And then one day, it was actually really random. I was in New York with my partner, and there was an Earthlings Experience event happening, and we were in the Museum of Modern Art, and it was happening in Times Square, and we were like, oh, we're just around the corner, should we do it? And we thought, well, why not? We've got nothing else to do. And it was just kind of random. We had no intention of going along necessarily, but we just ended up there and absolutely loved it. I had a great time, really enjoyed the conversations I had, and then was kind of hooked from that moment on. So again, what I'd always say to someone is, if you're worried or nervous, that's natural and it's important, because it means that you care. But don't let that stop you, because the moment you get there and you get into it and you see how these outreach events work or how they operate, you'll feel so confident and empowered, and you'll leave feeling so good about yourself because you know you've made a difference. And I think activism is very addictive. So I kind of regret taking 5 months, you know, before I got involved. But yeah, it's a strange thing, really. When I think about my activism journey, I look at all the different stages. I can see my mentality, and I could see what I was thinking at the time, and how it then progressed onwards to the next step, into the next step. And I look back at what I was doing then, and if I knew what I was doing now, I wouldn't believe it for a second. I'd be like, you're talking about a different person. There's no way that's Ed doing those things.
Do you think the way that you did it gave you a different perspective? So when you were able to go out there, you were in a different place, or if you could do it again, would you immediately do both the digital and the on the street at the same time?
I mean, I think what worked to my advantage was doing the online digital stuff first meant that I'd researched an awful lot because I was making a lot of videos about varying aspects of veganism, you know, clothing as well as food and entertainment as well. And because of that, I was armed with a lot of knowledge. And if I'd gone straight into it in January 2016, I'd have not really known how to speak to anyone. And I wouldn't have had that knowledge at my disposal. What I would wish I had done was would cram that knowledge in as quickly as possible and get out there quickly, you know, get there quicker. But I think it worked to my advantage having that little break, because there's 5 months I was solidly making video. I was solidly learning about all these different topics and tangents of veganism and tangents of animal exploitation. And that worked to my favor massively for when I actually got out there on the street. So research is so important, and also practice. And now practice means going out there and physically doing it, but it also means practice with yourself in the mirror, practice in the shower, practice with your partner or your friend. What is a common justification that someone's going to use to excuse not going vegan? Say it out loud, and then say out loud what your response will be to that, and then move on to a different excuse, and just practice as much as you possibly can. And what I've found, at least, is that over time, you begin to realize that people will tend to use the same justifications and the same excuses. And it normally always boils down to taste, right? So learn about the most common justifications, and you can respond to them accordingly. And the more you do it, the more confident you'll get, and the easier it becomes.
So you mentioned research was a major part of your current approach. So for someone who is like, okay, maybe I should do some research and not just go with the crowd, what would be some go-to sources that you would recommend?
Yeah, great question. Documentaries, I think, are brilliant. So Earthlings for America is brilliant. Teach you so much about the ways we slaughter animals. I think a lot of the time as vegans, we shy away from the animal cruelty, which is completely understandable. No one wants to see that graphic footage. But I think it's important we see it at least once, because then we actually know what happens. And we all have an idea of what goes on in these facilities. But until you actually see it, I don't think you can properly communicate what it's like. And I think when you see it, it kind of adds extra credibility to your argument. So I would say to everyone, watch Earthlings. If you're in the US and you live near, watch Earthlings. Also, Cowspiracy, brilliant, great about the environment. What the Health of Forks Over Knives for Health are really good. And there's an abundance of other ones on Netflix. Live and Let Live, I think, is one. And there's more coming out. Seaspiracy documentary about fishes coming out, Eating Ourselves to Extinction. So there's always new films coming out. Great things about health. Dr. Greger's How Not to Die, I think, is an infallible tool just for kind of basic health knowledge. Now, I'm not an expert but on the health sides of veganism, but I do think it's important that we kind of have a brief understanding of, you know, why animal products cause cancer, or why they cause heart disease, or what is it about animal products that are detrimental to our health, and what is it about plant products that are good for our health. Just, you don't need to know the ins and outs of everything, but the very basics, I think, really help. And I'm trying to think what else. Actually, there's a really great book that I read, and it's called The Morality of Eating Animals. It's by Gary Francione, the animal rights activist, and it really covered so much about veganism. And that for me was a really invaluable tool at the beginning of my activism journey. So if there's one book I'd recommend, it'd probably be the Gary Francione one, The Morality of Eating Animals. Again, the internet is a useful resource for us vegans, and social media has really revolutionized veganism, and it's allowed us to have access to independent information that, you know, older generations didn't have access to. And before social media, people relied on what the media was telling us, what the, you know, the industries themselves were telling us, what politicians were telling us. But now we have social media, we're not restrained by those kind of, or we're not constrained by those restraints, which means that we have access to that information, freedom of information. So utilize social media to kind of learn the unbiased and impartial aspects of the information that's out there.
So we'll be putting all of those recommendations in our notes. So don't worry if you're watching this and like, I got to pause it every single 2 seconds. So amazing resources. So now I want to go back a little bit before you put the YouTube. What made you want to become vegan? And Ryan, when did this happen in your journey?
So let's go back to May. When would it be? May? I'll be my 4 years ago, no, May 2014, I think it was. This is when the first kind of like main thing triggered in my head about it. And I came across this story, basically, and it was about this truck full of chickens on the way to the slaughterhouse had crashed on the motorway. And I was reading, it was in BBC News, and I was reading about it, and the journalist was saying that I think it was like 1,500 of these animals had died on the impact on the crash. And there were hundreds more that were mutilated. They had broken wings, broken bones. They were dying on the side of the road. And even more so, what disturbed me was there's some running for freedom, running to like the nearby fields and even running into oncoming traffic. And it really disturbed me and shook me. And I remember thinking how horrible it must be for these animals. And they must be suffering terribly. And the ones that are alive must be so scared and so full of fear. But I realized that, well, actually, in my fridge just over there, there's some dead chickens. And the only reason they were in that truck is because I was paying for them to be there. And it was hypocritical of me to feel sorry for these animals when I was the one that sentenced them to that situation. And if anything, the ones that had died in impacts had a more pleasant death than the ones that had made it to the slaughterhouse, because their death would have been instantaneous. But the ones that had taken to the slaughterhouse had the fear as they'd been hung upside down and dragged to that electric water bath, or, you know, had their throats cut. So I went vegetarian after that because, well, I mean, I didn't know about the egg and dairy industries, but I couldn't sit comfortably with myself knowing that the animals that I ate had emotions like fear and pain and suffering. And it was interesting because it was the first time that I actually recognized these animals did suffer. It's funny because it seems so obvious that, of course, these animals are alive, they suffer, but we never think about it. And I acknowledged very easily that dogs and cats felt pain and wanted to live and had a preference to live. But the animals on my plate, for some reason, I didn't think they had those same abilities are those same ones. So it forced me to reevaluate how I viewed the animals that I would normally see on my plate. And I realized, actually, these animals are just the same as me, or the animals that I love, and they want to live. And because they want to live, how do I justify taking their life? And there wasn't a justification, because there isn't one. So that was what made me go veggie. And then my partner, this is about 8 months later, she says we should watch Earthlings. And I said to her, no, I'm not gonna watch that. I knew a little bit what it was about, and I'm like, there's no way I'm gonna watch that. I'm a vegetarian. Animals don't die for me, right? That kind of old, you know, that thought that many of us have had as vegetarians. That's what I thought. Animals don't die for me. There's no need for me to watch Earthlings. I even said veganism is extreme. I said that myself. One day she put it on. I thought, okay, let's just watch it. So I watched it, and that was kind of it. After that, I was like, oh, this is serious. So this is far bigger than just meat. In fact, it's far bigger than just the animal products that we eat. This is everything: clothing, cosmetics, animal testing, entertainment. The magnitude of it, it dawned on me in that moment, is so huge and so vast that simply being vegetarian didn't even come close to being enough. So that was what triggered me then to look up the environment and the health and go vegan.
And along those lines of your progression, you know, I'm so glad to hear that you did, only because of where you stand right now, that it wasn't just like immediate. You had, even though you went through that incident with that article, became vegetarian, there was still room for you to move forward into where you are today. And I know hopefully a lot of people listening to that will realize that, hey, it's just being conscious of what's actually happening and arming yourself with the knowledge. Yeah. To be able to, you know, eventually make that shift. Because I hear a lot, you know, veganism is extreme. But the point that I want to make now is, do you recognize any seeds that might have been planted prior to you reading that article that made you make that shift?
So, you know what, I'm really happy you asked this question, because this is something I'd actually been thinking about recently. Now, I think, how old will I have been? So I was in school. This won't mean anything to you guys. I was in secondary school in year 8. So I don't know what that the equals of that is in the US, but I would have been about, I guess, 12 maybe. And it was an English literature class. And I don't really remember why, but for some reason, the topic of vegetarianism came up, and we had a vegetarian. There was a vegetarian girl in my class. And I remember I raised my hand in the air, and the teacher was like, yes, Edwards. And I went, all vegetarians are weak, pale, and skinny. And I remember this vegetarian girl in my class was so angry at me. She was furious at me. But in my head, I didn't understand why she should be angry, because I thought I was just stating the truth. I mean, it was kind of really ironic, because I was pale, weak, and skinny myself. So it was really, the irony was totally lost on me. But I'm saying that vegetarians are pale, weak, and skinny. I ate meat, and I was also pale, weak, and skinny. But it was kind of funny. But I didn't understand why she was angry at me. And I think that's what kind of this thought went through my head of, oh, Am I not just stating facts? Now, you see, vegetarianism, the only time it was ever brought up in my family was when it was being mocked, and when it was being judged. And for whatever reason, my family weren't very tolerant of the concept of vegetarians. And it was a joke. And I think that societal conditioning had been so installed in my head that it was just an automatic reaction for me to say that that's what vegetarians were like. I didn't even register whether it was a good thing to say or a bad thing to say. I just blurted out because that's what I'd been told. But her being angry at me caused this reaction in me to think, well, actually, why is she angry at me? And I looked at her and I thought, well, she's not pale and she's certainly stronger than I am. So maybe there's something about this vegetarianism. But obviously, I went home and continued eating animal products with, you know, without ever questioning it. But I think that was a little bit of a moment. And then I had a few, I came to university. So now I'm 18. And I actually became friends with a lot of vegetarians. And they would, you know, obviously make a point of being vegetarian. And by that, I mean, when we ordered food, you know, it was always vegetarian. They'd never cheated on it or anything like that. And I think being around those people influenced me a lot. And kind of taught me a lot about being vegetarian and what it was. Now, I didn't know a single vegan. And when I went vegan with my partner, we had never met a vegan in our life. To be honest, I was a bit of a reluctant vegan. Like, I was like, I'm doing it for the animals, but I don't enjoy it. Like, I want to eat those animal products, you know? And that's kind of how it was at the beginning. Like, I really missed it. And I missed eating things like halloumi and getting Domino's pizza and stuff. And I think what we often portray ourselves is going vegan, and then that's it, we're straight in there. But it's not quite as true as that. And for me, when I first went vegan, I did miss those products. I mean, there was no denying that, and I did crave them and I did want them. But that kind of evolution of my veganism is quite apparent to see that it took me several months before I really felt comfortable with it and I fully understood it. And I thought, actually, you know what, now I get it. Now I feel it, and this is something that I'm going to do for life. Because I think when I first went vegan, I'd say stuff like, one day I'll have a burger again, or I'll have a fried egg, or whatever, you know, whatever it was that would keep me going at that time, I'll have halloumi again. It was kind of like a way of making myself feel better about it, because I was really scared that, oh, I'm never going to eat these things again. People are going to judge me. I've never met a vegan before. I'm going to go into uni and everyone's going to be like, what are you thinking? So my little get out of jail clause was, one day I'll eat halloumi again, or whatever it was. And that kind of stuck with me for the first 8 weeks or so. And then I felt, now I get it. This is what I'm doing. This is why I'm doing it. I'm never going to go back. It all clicked into place kind of rather suddenly. A little bit off tangent to what you asked, but I can see in my head this progression of how I am today. And it really does feel like these stages of my life. And I don't know if maybe you feel the same, or anyone who's listening feels the same, but I look back on who I was before I was vegan and I just don't recognize myself. And I think, who was this person that enjoyed these things? And who was this person who loved bacon and loved, you know, chicken flesh and loved all these things? I don't know who that person was. It doesn't feel like it was ever me. It feels like a different person. And that those memories have somehow got installed in my head by mistake. It's a funny thing, but I don't know. It's just to see that progression, I feel it makes me really pleased, because I know that it is a journey, and the beauty of veganism is that the journey never ends. And I know where I'm going to be next year. I'm going to look back on who I am now and go, who was I back then? This is a different person to the person I am now. And that's the beauty of it, is it's such a journey, and we meet more people on that journey. We meet more activists, we meet more vegans, the community grows, it gets easier and more accessible in society, and it's a beautiful thing. We're living in a very exciting time, and there's such a massive change, a radical change happening, particularly where I am in the UK and where you guys are in the US. There's such a fundamental shift going on that I cannot wait to see where we are in 5 years' time and to see this progression continue.
Yeah, no, there's definitely an awakening. And I think one of the powerful things that we have at our disposal are these platforms to educate people on the realities of what veganism is, and that there's many shapes and forms of it. So I say that to talk about the more controversial side of veganism, the thought that you might have had in your head, and I know I had in my head before I became vegan, of vegan being this extreme thing, and that, especially in the realm that you operate in, of activists being considered or called terrorists and things of that nature. So what is your take on that? How do you feel about those labels? Do you feel that in certain cases it's justified, or is it just a misconception of the people who are on the other side of the activism?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that's really important at the moment, this terminology. Now, as I said earlier, I did think veganism was extreme. I don't think vegans were extremists, but I thought the notion of veganism was an extreme ideology. Like, it, to me, it just didn't make any sense. But I think what we're seeing now is a bit more sinister than that kind of way of thinking. And it's this was always going to happen. There's always going to be this backlash. I think it's really beginning to murmur because we're doing so well as a movement at the moment and progressing so quickly. There is this backlash happening, and especially in the mainstream media here in the UK, it's been an onslaught for the past couple of weeks about vegans being domestic terrorists and militant, and we're sending death threats, we're threatening children. You know, apparently we're doing these horrible, unspeakable things. But the problem is, it's not founded in any evidence. That there's no proof of this happening. It's completely slanderous. And I think it's quite clear to me what's going on. We've been doing such a good job recently, well, for the past few years, of telling the truth, of, you know, speaking the truth and raising awareness. Now, these industries have operated under secrecy for so long. And that's what's worked in their advantage, that people simply didn't know what happened. You know, the fact that many people still don't know that cows need to give birth to produce milk is really a credit to the secrecy of the industries themselves and the misinformation they're releasing. It's astonishing that people weren't aware of that, or people aren't aware of that. And if they're not aware of that, how can they possibly be aware of the fact that babies are taken off their mothers in the dairy industry, the fact that, you know, male calves are sometimes shot, the fact that we mutilate, you know, piglets and chickens and all sorts. People just simply aren't aware. Now, we're showing that information and we're telling the truth. And because we're telling the truth, the farmers and the mainstream media can't argue with what we're saying. They can't discredit the information we're saying because it is true and it can't be denied. These regulations and these laws, these welfare laws, are enshrined, written down in, you know, in laws or in guidelines, and they're there for everyone to see if you want to look for them, and as such, they can't be argued against. So what the farmers have quickly realized, as well as the mainstream media, is that they can't attack the information, they have to attack us as individuals. And because they can't discredit the information, they have to discredit who's saying the information, right? It's a really cheap tactic, and it's been used so many times in the past. And what they're trying to do is make the general public not trust us. And if they don't trust us, they don't trust what we're saying. We have in the UK a lot of this perpetuation of, like, the notion of, like, humble, hardworking, poor British farmers. They're struggling to make a living. They're you know, they get up at 4 a.m. just to make ends meet. They love their animals. And all of a sudden, these violent city goers, vegans, are threatening a whole way of life. And they're trying to disturb a whole way of living. And these animal lovers are actually attacking the people who care for animals and raise animals. And that's the kind of rhetoric they're trying to put out there to make us seem untrustworthy and violent. And it is a challenging thing. Now, I guess it's a positive thing in a sense that there's that concept of the three stages of truth, right? First they mock you, then they fight you, then you win, right? So, and I really do believe that we've progressed so far past the mocking stage now, where veganism is very normal in many senses, and it's very common, so people can't mock it anymore because it's not a strange ideology. But what they then do is they get angry at it, and they're trying to fight it back and try and, you know, discredit us. So I think we are seeing progression made, and I think this is a good sign, even though it's a turbulent period of time for us to be in. What's so important to note is that we have the responsibility now to disprove what the mainstream media is saying. So if they're labeling us as being violent and extremists, then we've got to be calm. We've got to be peaceful, we've got to be compassionate, and we've got to fight for justice, but do so in a way that isn't perpetuating these notions of extremism, right? So if they're saying that we're sending death threats, then but it kind of goes about saying that we should be sending death threats. And as far as I'm aware, I've not seen any evidence of vegans sending, you know, death threats. It's interesting because I can go through my inbox on Facebook and I can find a few that I receive from farmers, but at the same time, it frustrates me because I can go through my comment section, I see these death threats being said to me, but the farmers say they're getting death threats, and there's no evidence of that whatsoever. Now, obviously, I'm not saying all farmers are aligned to the farmers that send those death threats, but at the same time, I think there's a clear aggression, and it's not coming from our side. But it's so important that means that we continue being peaceful, we continue being rational and logical and calm and effective, and over time, that means that this notion of militancy and extremism won't work anymore. And it'll become a narrative that's old and overused and people won't believe it. So if we keep doing what we're doing, which has been strong role models and strong activists, then over time, this whole media attack and farmers attack will disband because it's not grounded in any facts or grounded in reality. I know, and lies like that can only persist for a certain amount of time. And it's difficult now, but it will stop.
And, you know, we're going to move from this topic, but I do want to kind of address something you mentioned as far as the different stages. So we're, so right now it looks like we're coming out of the mocking stage, going into the fighting stage. So if that's the case, this is new terrain for leaders in the animal rights movement. So what advice, and you gave a lot of great advice, but specifically towards us navigating this new area, what advice would you have? Because you do have to look at the past, look at history, look at other movements where they did get into this terrain, and many of them are. There's very few that have won, you know? I really, maybe you can think of one or two, but it's always in that fight stage where you have to directly appeal to the people. And I think that's what this being on the street and having the access to social media provides. But you have the corporate, and I don't want to get into whole conspiracy theories, whatever, but you have the corporations, you have evidence of other movements where you have plants, you have people who are compromised. So how do, speaking specifically to leaders of these movements, how do they move in a move in a direction and be mindful of things that could potentially occur?
Yeah, I think it is good to look at things that have happened in the past to other movements, whether it be civil rights, LGBT rights, women's rights, whatever social justice issue it is. We should draw upon their experiences. I think what works in our favor is although I fight for the animals and I come from veganism from an ethical standpoint, there's so many ways into veganism. It could be for the environment or for the health, for your health. It could even be for human rights, you know, issues that people will always naturally come to veganism for their own reasons. And even if, say, they try to smear, you know, animal rights activists, that's not going to stop people becoming vegan. So I think we have that works in our favor. And what also works in our favor is the community that we have. Now, we have such a strong knit community, and it's global. Other social justice movements in the past were the bulk of their fighting was happening before social media and before kind of that, the ability to connect globally. We're right in the middle of that right now. And as our movement's really kicking off, we're utilizing that ability to become a community. I mean, like what we're doing right now wouldn't have been able to happen, you know, 15, 20 years ago. And it certainly wouldn't be able to happen when civil rights was happening. It certainly wouldn't be able to happen when suffragettes were going on. So, right. So we have this new kind of technology. We have this new capabilities that will help us. And because we have such a strong community, we have support from each other and we can rely on each other to help and for guidance. So even though we have leaders within the movement, it's not necessarily about those leaders. It's about all these individuals that are coming together and fighting for the same thing. And with that end goal, end target in mind. Now, we're fighting for so much. There's so much at stake. It's not just the lives of trillions of animals, or indeed the lives of humans that are oppressed in animal agriculture. It's the life of the planet itself, which fundamentally means all life. We have such a huge goal to aim for that, to me, there's absolutely no way that we can fail. Because if we keep what's at stake in mind, then we will never be able to be quiet or rest or be silent when we know that the future of every single living being, not just ourselves, but our children, our grandchildren, indeed all life, is going to be affected unless we make changes today and tomorrow and every day that we can. And for that reason alone, I think people always have that passion inside of us, that fire inside of us to keep going, to keep fighting. And this movement is going to change. It's going to grow in so many ways, and we will face opposition. There will be difficulties from politicians, from governments, from plants, even from corporations and capitalist organizations that have money and have political power. But what we have is so fundamental. We just have the truth on our side. And what we're fighting for is so, I use the word pure. I don't know if that's the right word, but I mean, it's so, I think, well, maybe pure is the right word. It's so pure in the sense of what we're fighting for is just so simple. It's just nonviolence. Now, all social justice movements have had those themes of nonviolence, but ours is just, it's a global nonviolence towards all beings. And because it's so overarching and because it includes every single living being, we have so much support from all around the world, and that will continue to grow. And I don't know, maybe I'm rambling a little bit, but I just, what works to our advantage is the sheer scale of what we're fighting for and the fact that there's so many of us involved and people are becoming more and more passionate about it every single day. And in the 2 years that I've been active, the change I've seen, not just in terms of veganism, but in terms of vegan activism, has been absolutely astonishing. There's more and more people get involved all the time. There's more and more people wanting to do something all the time. And that's not going to stop. And they may attack certain individuals. They may, you know, the mainstream media, media may try and smear leaders, and they may try and smear campaign groups. But that, it won't change anything. People are so invested in this. That they're not going to stop, and regardless of what happens.
And speaking of not stopping, regardless of what happens, you have a animal rights you're involved with. You helped found the animal rights march that you had in London. Now it's global. I had the opportunity to participate in the one in Miami during while it was happening around the globe, and just to see the community come out and have a common message and really turn heads in terms of things that people weren't aware of. It's a powerful sight to behold. So would you tell me a little bit more about how that came about? And for people who might not know what I'm talking about, ground them in that.
Yeah, so the first animal rights march that we held was in 2016. And I don't know, we just felt that there needed to be a march in the UK that was on behalf of all animals. We had anti-hunting marches, we had anti-vivisection and animal testing marches, but there just needs to be something that was encompassing every animal, you know, wild animals, animals that we exploit for food and clothing, everything. And so we decided to set up the official animal rights march. And I remember that in 2016, we were absolutely amazed. There was about 2,500 people there. And that was just, it was a phenomenal thing. And we were so pleased about it. But then last year in 2017, we had 5,000 people there. And what I really like about the Animal Rights March is that it is showing a progression. And it's showing that actually people are getting more involved. There are more vegans, there are more activists. Because we doubled our numbers in the space of 365 days or whatever it was. You know, we doubled our numbers. And we're hoping to see this shift continue. And last year we had, as you said, it went more global. So we had marches in Hungary and in the US, of course. And again, the participation there was phenomenal. And in New York, they had about 2,500 people in the first one they did. So the reason for the march really is to get people together and create that sense of community. You know, we are a movement that is made of individuals. And when we are strongest is when we're fighting together. And that community spirit gives people that kind of empowerment to know that we are, there are thousands, literally tens of thousands of people all in this together, all the time fighting. And it empowers people to know that they're not alone. But at the same time, it sends a very clear message to the outside world that actually animal rights is a serious issue. It's something that's going to continue. It's something that needs to be taken seriously. And I think as the march progresses each year, we're going to see that continuation of more and more participation, but also people taking this more and more seriously. And as the event becomes more global, so this year, not only are we in the US, in the UK, we're going to be in Canada, Australia, France, Germany, the Philippines, Taiwan. It really is exploding. And we want it to become a global event that's annual and signifies the fact that this community exists everywhere, in every continent, in every country, and that this ideology of compassion, non-violence, is just a universal ideology, and it applies to everyone from any walk of life, from any culture, from any religion, from any political viewpoint. We're all connected by that one idea that simply not harming others is the only moral way to live. So the march is about empowering people. It's a celebration of what we've achieved in the year. It's a celebration of what we've achieved as a movement, but it's also a grounding and a reminder of everything we have to do and the challenges and battles that lie ahead.
And this, so that brings me to the nonprofit organization that you're affiliated with, Surge Activism.
Yeah, that's right.
So tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so that was set up in June 2016. And the reason for it was we wanted a London-based animal rights group that was kind of doing on-the-street campaigning. You know, we have animal rights organizations like PETA, for example, and Animal Equality is another one here in the UK, and Animal Aid, and a couple of others that exist in the UK who do a lot of good work, but there wasn't much on-the-street grassroots. And what we wanted is we wanted an organization that would kind of bring together the grassroots community and form kind of, I use the word community a lot, I feel like I've been saying it a lot, but that's kind of what our aim was, to form that community. And that was kind of our main mission. It was to, you know, obviously fight on behalf of animals and do as much as we could to hold, you know, corporations and businesses to account for their exploitation of animals. But it was also to galvanize people and bring them together and create that solid platform and solid community. And that was the thinking behind it. And so we do a whole range of events. We do anti-fur protesting. We do outreach events where we hand out free samples of vegan chocolates and plant milks and vegan cheeses and show people that, hey, you know, vegan food is delicious. Who'd have thought it, right? And it's affordable and it's accessible and exists all around us, and just making it that bit easier for people. The Animal Rights March is another thing. And we're currently doing a university tour. So last year, myself and my partner made a documentary called Land of Hope and Glory, which was basically an expose of UK animal farming. And we were touring around universities in the UK, screening the film, doing outreach with the students, and kind of just generating conversations with students about what happens here in the UK, about the ways that we treat animals, and kind of debunking so many of those myths about, you know, humane slaughter and free range and stuff, and just kind of spreading the truth as much as we can. So our main mission is to galvanize communities, but also just to spread awareness and hopefully teach people.
Okay. And if they wanted more information on both the March and Surge, where could they go?
Yeah. So there's a Facebook page, Surge, and also a Facebook page for the Official Animal Rights March. We also have a website, which is surgeactivism.com. And there's a website for the Animal Rights March, which is www.theofficialanimalrightsmarch.com as well.
And we will make sure we put those on our notes on soulfulvegans.com. Plug. What I want to do is ask you some questions, and then we're going to wind it down. Yep. So, first question comes from one of our members, Francesco Barbati, and his question is: How did you learn to handle and how did you handle your way of speaking with omnivores? You're truly an inspiration to him.
Oh, well, thanks, Francesco. That's very kind of you to say. It was practice. And I think it's important to use the word practice when we talk about these things, because it will never be perfect. And, I make mistakes. Everyone makes mistakes. It's not always going to go well. You'll have a conversation with someone and you'll feel that you didn't do the best that you could do. I think what helped me was when I had those conversations that were difficult, I took the time to reflect on them. And I questioned, well, why did that go wrong? What is it that went wrong? How could I change it? What can I say next time to make myself better? Now I'm going to go right back to what we said in the beginning, which is research and practice. Those are the two most fundamental things. I think the reason that we often get frustrated and angry is because someone will say something to us and we won't know how to respond. And when we don't know how to respond, we get frustrated that we don't know, which in turn becomes anger. And I think often when people get angry, it's because they don't know what to say, and they feel like maybe they're being made to look, you know, stupid or uneducated, or maybe even worse, they're doing an injustice to the animals and a disservice to their suffering because they're not properly talking on their behalf. So research as much as possible, because then you're less likely to end up in a situation where you don't know what to respond with. And that's what helps me kind of stay as mellow as possible. Now, as I said, look, we're all human and we all care deeply and passionately about the cause, which means that we will make mistakes, and sometimes people will rile us up and ruffle our feathers, right? And we will react in a way that, you know, maybe isn't always that calm. That's okay, right? It's natural. The important thing is to reflect on that and understand why that happened. And next time, if it does occur, we'll know what to do. Maybe it's best to step away from the conversation. Maybe it's best to ask this question or ask that question. And it's all a process. But what we have to do is we have to get out there, you know, get talking to people, have those difficult conversations. That's the only way we can progress and learn, I suppose. I mean, it is learning and it's an education, and that's what excites me about it, is there's always room to grow. So for me, it was just a matter of that. And if you also want to, go on YouTube and look at like effective communication skills. There's an abundance of information on YouTube about of body language and how body language can mean so much to the person you're speaking to, how it can make you seem calm or aggressive or relatable if you're listening. So I think learn about body language, learn about, you know, techniques that kind of, you know, because how we kind of position ourselves, the tone of voice we use and the kind of demeanor we have speaks volumes to the person we're speaking to. So it's not just the words coming out of our mouth, but the way that we're acting in general. So I think that's another really important tool, is just kind of learn about effective communication.
What are your thoughts on the different types of science, the manipulation of clean meats. You know, what are your thoughts in regards to that and its potential impact on animal farming?
I come from it from two point of views. I mean, firstly, if we can get to a point where the only animal flesh that's been eaten is this clean meat thing, then man, that's brilliant. That's fantastic. If that ends the exploitation of animals, then I'm all for it. But I'm also disappointed that that's the solution that we have. It's not necessary. And the thing is, when we can survive from eating plants, we don't need to be doing these laboratory things. Now, obviously, morally, if there's no animal suffering, then it's a good thing. But the only issue I have is it still normalizes the ideology that consuming animal flesh is natural. And quite simply, it isn't anymore. And we shouldn't be perpetuating that myth. And I think it just speaks volumes about the arrogance and stubbornness of our species that we will wait 30 years to get clean meat rather than simply switching to a veggie burger today. So I'm really pleased about it because I think it will change everything. But I'm just disappointed that that's what we need to change everything, if that makes sense.
I definitely hear your point. And the next question I have kind of ties into something you just said. Mm. What is your vision for the world? Where do you see the world in your lifetime in the future?
Yeah.
With the work that you're doing, what is an ideal vision for you for the world?
I mean, I always like to be idealistic, I think. It kind of keeps me going. Idealistically, right? Okay, so the vision I have, let's go with the vision I want, right? This is what I dream of, this is what I want, is that when I'm, I'm old and I'm coming to the end of my life, I'm living in a totally different world. And in this world, there's no such thing as a slaughterhouse. So there is, but they're now, like a relic of our old, violent past. And these farms are no longer there for animals. They're either arable farms and plant farms, or they're sanctuaries for animals. And, animals are not being bred into these systems of horror and violence. Inherently, the ideal that I have and I dream of and think about is being old and living in an entirely vegan world. Now, I don't believe that's realistic. So that's my ideal and that's what I'm striving for. But if I'm being realistic, I think it's very plausible to think that we will see radical change. And I do believe that in terms of the West, we will see things like the abolishing of factory farming. I think this clean meat kind of venture will probably be incredibly successful. And I think for sustainability reasons alone, those things will have to happen, even if it's not from an ethical point of view. But I don't inherently believe that we'll have ended animal exploitation. I think that on many levels, people will still be hunting, maybe. People will still not necessarily have the same mentality that we have towards the way that animals will be treated. But what I know is that there'll be such a massive change. Now, the issue is, and this is what I struggle with, is we're making change happens so quickly, but every other social justice movement is still fighting those fights. And the suffragettes, were around 100 years ago, and I think in the UK they got, some women got the right to vote 100 years ago, but we're not there yet when it comes to women's rights, and we're certainly not there when it comes to civil rights. And these campaigns and these movements have been around for decades. Now, veganism in its current form is still relatively new. Now, animal rights has been around for decades, but veganism in its current form is still relatively new. And I think when I look at other social justice movements, and I acknowledge the progress they've made, but I ground myself with how much there is still to go. And I think the current world we're living in is a massive indictment of how much there is still to go. And so for me, I think when I get to the end of my life, there will be massive change, but there'll still be a lot to go. And for me, I see what I do and what other activists are doing now as a way of laying the groundwork for other activists in the future to kind of push on for that vegan world. I mean, look, we have to change because the world can't sustain our current way of life. There's no way around that. We have to make drastic changes. So hopefully they'll happen in time, fingers crossed. But for me, it's about laying that groundwork and doing everything I can to achieve that world. I'd love to be in a vegan world by the end of my life. And that's what I have in my head and that's what I dream of. But I'm aware that that might not always be as achievable as I sometimes think or sometimes hope it will be.
And closing on this final question, and it's a doozy of a question, so brace yourself. So SoFlo Vegans, our goal is to help South Florida become a global hotspot for veganism. Because by doing that, we can help create a model that other areas that might not already be a global hotspot or be a hub for vegan activity can look at, and we can share, and we can grow globally across the plains and the hills and the treetops. So with that being said, you've traveled a lot. You've gone, you know, a lot of different places. What are some places that stand out to you in terms of thriving vegan communities, and not even just from a food standpoint, but from the activist standpoint? You know, what are some places that other people could maybe visit to gain some inspiration?
That's a good question. So I think for me, New York is incredibly progressive in terms of veganism, and the number of food options is fantastic. But I think there's a good strong core activism group there. Now, this may be a little bit biased, right? Bear with me. But I honestly, for me, the hub of so much is in London right now and in the UK. And the reason why this works is because the UK is so small, and what that means is we can all work together from different cities now, and all the major cities in the UK are all 5 hours driving distance, you know, so we have that ability to come together and work together on big campaigns. And so if you want to get involved in some good activism, I think the UK is a really strong thing. We've got safe movements everywhere. We've got Anonymous the Voice. This is everywhere. There's so many strong outreach groups and direct action groups that I really think that it is very progressive in terms of grassroots activism. Now, in Europe, what I'm really pleased about is this shift that's happening. Now, I was in Hungary in early December, and Hungary is not somewhere where you'd think that there'd be much veganism, and definitely not somewhere you'd think there'd be much activism. But what I was so incredibly pleased to see was actually that there was a community that was growing, and it was growing very, very recently, and it was quite a new thing. And this is what I've started to see across a lot of Europe, especially places in Eastern Europe, is there's that kind of that grassroots scene is building. So I think in terms of places to visit and go, for me, America and Canada and the UK are definitely the top in terms of the size of it and the scale of what's happening. But in terms of kind of seeing like from the ground up going on, places like Spain, Hungary, are showing a lot of promise. And I'm excited to see where they're going to end up in these kind of traditionally more heavy meat eating, kind of Catholic or religious, perhaps, kind of backgrounds. You know, the UK is quite secular, and we've been, you know, historically slightly more progressive, and it makes sense that veganism would kind of be blossoming quite strongly here. But I'm particularly pleased about is these places where you wouldn't imagine veganism to be and seeing it really blossom is it's a beautiful thing to behold. So if you come to London.
All right. Well, thank you so much for all of your insight, you sharing your history and your story with other people, because that's how we learn. That's, you know, through actual examples of people, you know, going through their process. And in hearing that you can go from being a 12-year-old boy, you know, making fun of the vegetarian, not purposefully, but, you know, to, you know, being where you are right now, lets people know that, hey, you know what, I have an opportunity to learn, to arm myself with the knowledge, and then live a life of compassion, kindness, and be in service to all beings. So.
Right.
With that being said, thank you so much for being on our first episode of the podcast. Thank you.
How exciting. Yeah.
Through my open. and any final remarks, anything where we can check you out, anything that's coming up that you want to let the people know about?
So, yeah. So the social media is the best place. So I've got Instagram, Facebook and YouTube, all left linked out if you want to check out some of the stuff that I'm doing. I will be in the US at the Berkeley Animal Liberation Conference and doing some things in the US around that time. So I will be doing a lot more traveling this year, and I'm really looking forward to kind of to get meet people that way. Not necessarily relevant, but I just kind of want to say right at the end is, you know, I think that we're getting to that point now where we all have an obligation to do what we can to progress this movement and to speak up on behalf of the animals and have those difficult conversations that maybe we want to avoid. But there's but we should all feel empowered to know that we each and every one of us has the capacity and the ability to make such a profound and radical change to the lives of every single living being on this planet. And when we acknowledge the power that we have as individuals, it's incredibly empowering to do that and to notice that actually me, you, whoever it is, have the ability to go out there and change the mind of someone and influence them to live a more compassionate life. So I just implore anyone who's listening, who's interested in getting active, interested in whatever it is, you know, related to veganism, to just get involved and do your bit, because you'll feel so good for it. And don't feel nervous. It's natural. Confidence will come as you progress and you do more and more.